And welcome to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm the news director at WCAI. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Chris Lindahl, and Chris is with the Cape Cod Times. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Sean.
It's your inaugural appearance here on the roundup. Thanks That's for coming great. In.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We'll also be joined by Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with a story from today's paper, Chris. A fire in Falmouth, and when first responders got in there, they found a woman who was dead.
That's right. Firefighters found the body of Carrie Blevins. She's 43, and she was found dead at this Edgewater Drive East home in East Falmouth. That's a ranch home. Mm. And there was a bedroom fire on the first floor that firefighters found and were quickly able to extinguish. That remains under investigation by police, fire, the state fire marshal's office, and the state police.
Sounds like there wasn't a lot of smoke, and they were very surprised. It sounds like they were surprised to find someone in there.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't that large of a fire, firefighters say.
We'll have to continue to follow that story. Let's move on to the town of Dennis, where a warrant article will appear at town meeting. People are asking to weigh in on the whole debate around immigration and enforcing federal laws.
Yeah, this petition article was brought forward by Leonard Solomon. Yeah, he's a South Dennis resident, and he says this is not about making Dennis a sanctuary town. It's really just about making sure that immigrants, people in the immigrant community, feel comfortable enough to go forward to police if they ever have a experience any type of crime or a victim of a crime. And this article would direct town officials not to use any money or other town resources to enforce federal immigration law. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Police Chief Peter DiMatteo says that this isn't going to change anything in Dennis because Dennis already doesn't enforce federal immigration law.
So how does it work? So if they pick someone up, they're not asking about status. They're not asking about what country they're from. They're just going to charge someone with whatever law they've been accused of breaking, unless it's a federal law, right? I mean, local police don't enforce federal law anyway. Is that what this is?
Yeah, that's right. So usually kind of at the center of the whole sanctuary city debate is what's called an ICE detainer request. Those are issued by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And the way that ICE would find out about an undocumented immigrant in police custody is through state police. So they'll send the fingerprints to state police. Local police will send the fingerprints. And then the state police will send those to ICE. And ICE can then issue one of these non-criminal detainer requests that says, please hold this person for 48 hours so we can possibly pick them up. And now the Dennis police chief says the fact is that they don't get any ICE detainer requests because by the time ICE gets this information, they're already in county custody. So they're at the county correctional facility in Bourne.
Oh, I see. Okay. So they've already gone through the process. They're probably at the county correction if they have not been released by a judge. Now, so does the county have a policy?
Yeah, actually, the county is very supportive of cooperating with ICE. In fact, just this year, since January 1st, ICE has already issued 6 detainer requests for inmates at the Barnstable County Correctional Facility. And in 2016, there was 11 detainer requests issued. And Special Sheriff Jeff Perry is very willing to cooperate with those.
And I think, if I remember correctly, last year, under the Obama administration, most of those detainers came from an immigrant that has some sort of criminal past. And so in this case, that may not necessarily be the situation. It may just be there could have been some sort of violation of their you know, whatever, they're here on a green card or what have you, and then it doesn't necessarily have to be a criminal or a violent act. And I understand that ICE was meeting with Barnstable County House of Correction facilities as well this week.
That's right. On Thursday, the sheriff's office met with ICE agents to talk about how they can better work together and how the sheriff's department could better inform the agency about which inmates might be priorities for them.
A top issue on the Cape on a perennial basis is the spraying of herbicides underneath power lines. Typically, that's done by Eversource. They spot spray different vegetation that they do not want growing up and perhaps impacting either access to power lines or the power lines themselves. And it seems like every year, communities are trying to fight that, and that's happening again. What's the latest?
Yeah, so the towns of Brewster, Dennis, Eastham, and Orleans, their appeal of Eversource's annual plan to spray those herbicides has been rejected by the Division of Administrative Law Appeals. The state says that those towns failed to show how these herbicides are affecting the public water supply, even though town officials and a lot of environmental groups are raising some big concerns about these chemicals leaching into the aquifer on the Cape, which of course is a single source aquifer, just one pool of water.
Yep, sits right below us, unlike much of the rest of the state. Much of the rest of the state is getting MWRA water that's being, you know, shipped miles and miles away. So it's not, if they're spraying, it's not like it's being drawn right from the ground where you are. So this is this is an administrative decision. So I imagine they can go on and appeal this to the courts. I think that's the process that they're kind of working through that they've done before. What do we expect next with this story? Does it sound like there's any alternatives?
Yeah, so the next step is to see whether the State Agricultural Department approves Eversource's 2017 spray list for 13 towns on the Cape that are set to be sprayed, and then they'll try to appeal that decision.
Then that could be appealed. Okay. Marine Biological Laboratory here in Woods Hole. A lot of turnover at the MBL in recent years and a lot happening. And now we hear that the most recent director is stepping down.
Yeah, Huntington Willard, he's been on the job for about 2 years as president and director of the Marine Biological Lab. So he's going to step down at the end of April to pursue his research interests. And perhaps maybe his most high profile moment was his response to an act of racial discrimination that occurred at the institution and kind of prompted a wider discussion about racism in the scientific community.
And I know that the MBL has a very strong relationship now with the University of Chicago. The director who's stepping down, he's not doing interviews. He's not talking about what this is about.
Yeah, that's right. He's staying pretty tight-lipped about all of this. So we don't really know much beyond what's been in some press releases.
And they say that he's going to be pursuing research. Is that right?
That's right. He has a research background in genomics, and he's going to be pursuing that.
Okay. And let's move on to another story. District Attorney's Office releasing some information about a lifeguard who drowned. And we've been looking forward to this because it was such a tragic story. This young lifeguard with tremendous swimming experience, lifeguarding experience, champion swimmer, who drowned during lifeguard tryouts. Give us the background and then tell us what we're learning from this report.
Jack Jakubek, he had been lifeguarding in Orleans for 2 summers, and he was attending the training last summer when he drowned. And this young man was a 4-year member of the State University of New York at Cortland swimming and diving team. He was the captain of that team.
Oh, yeah.
Really, really highly skilled swimmer, and so he was underwater for about an hour before his body was recovered, and the district attorney's office this week released his cause of death, which they say is asphyxia by drowning in a person with a seizure disorder. Now, Jakubek had nocturnal epilepsy, so this was a latent condition that it would occasionally come up at night when he was sleeping.
Mm-hmm. And so I think there was a question, did that have something to do with it? But his attorney now is saying, yes, he had that condition, but that did not contribute to his actual drowning.
Right. He says that it played no role in his death or drowning. And the cause of death actually confirms what the attorney and Jakubek's family had initially thought about the incident.
And so tell us there has been a lawsuit, I believe.
Yeah, there's been a lawsuit, and Orleans and the family reached a $100,000 settlement, which is the maximum amount allowed under state law for these types of municipal settlements. And so that just needs to be approved by a New York court. And that's where Jakubek is from. He's from Newburgh, New York.
Okay, a tragic thing there. We need to take a break. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. We're flying through the news of the week here on the Cape Islands and South Coast. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. I'm the news director here at the station. With me is Chris Lindahl. He is with the Cape Cod Times. Chris, let's talk about a local builder who has been accused of not completing work that he's been paid for. And there was a search for this man, and he was in court this week.
Yeah, Nicholas Willoughby, he's been facing charges for about a year. He's been accused of stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from Cape homeowners and subcontractors. But some of those charges were dismissed this week. Mm-hmm. But he's not off the hook. He's being held on $10,000 bail, which is a pretty high amount of bail, out of Barnstable and Orleans District Courts for some new charges. And those stem from a 2016 incident where he allegedly took $15,000 from an East Sandwich woman and more than $18,000 from a South Yarmouth man and never performed any work that he said he would for them.
And I know it was the Cape Cod Times that wrote about this a while back, and there was a search on for him. I think he was found down south somewhere, I think it was. And so they brought him to court, and so now he's facing these new charges. What's next in this? He's being held?
Yeah, so he's being held on those two instances of $10,000 bail, mm-hmm. and that's in Dukes County Jail in Edgartown.
Oh, okay. Okay, so we'll continue to follow that. I know I was watching on social media, people were very upset about this case, saying that it really gives a bad name to builders themselves. But it looks like those new charges there was kind of a surprise that some of those were, the original ones were put aside. Well, we'll continue to follow that story and find out what happens there. Let's go to the phone where Tim Wood is joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom in Chatham. Hello, Tim Wood.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about wastewater. I understand Chatham, Harwich, Selectmen, they're endorsing an intermunicipal wastewater agreement.
Yeah, now this agreement calls for sewage from Harwich to be pumped into Chatham for treatment at Chatham's wastewater plant. This agreement has been long in the making. A subcommittee composed of members of both towns' boards of selectmen have been negotiating it for months now, and they recently hammered out a few last details. They met in a special session last week after some Chatham selectmen raised a couple questions about the agreement, and they came to a meeting of the minds. And now, under this final agreement, what's going to happen is Harwich will pay Chatham more than $6.6 million over a 7-year period. For the ability to treat up to 300,000 gallons a day of sewage, which will be brought in mostly from the East Harwich area. Now, that's about 23% of the Chatham sewage plant's capacity. Now, that plant was upgraded a few years ago, and Chatham is currently only using just a fraction of its capacity. And even though, even with Chatham continuing to add sewers, there's going to be an excess capacity at that treatment plant for quite a while.
Tim, when you say brought in, do they pipe it in? Is it trucked in?
What's going to happen is Harwich is going to be going to town meeting in the spring with a $9 million funding article to fund this agreement and also to start the process of building sewer mains in the East Harwich area. Those sewer mains will connect with the Chatham sewer system at the corner of Queen Anne Road and 137, which is where the two towns, where the border is. Chatham is also going to town meeting in the spring for an additional funds to continue its sewer project, which will include putting mains in that East Route 137 corridor area, so they'll be ready to hook up to Harwich when they're done. Now, the win-win here is that Chatham gets some funding to sort of supplement its the expenses of the operating the sewer treatment plant, as well as the upgrade costs that Chatham had to pay a few years ago. Also, by sewering the East Harwich area, Harwich will take care of a lot of the nitrogen loading that goes into the Pleasant Bay watershed, which, as you know, is shared by both Chatham, Harwich, and Orleans. So it's going to help with the cleanup of that area. So officials say that, you know, it's a regional solution to a problem that that is shared between several towns here. And what's going to happen is these questions are going to be on in Chatham. It's going to be on the town meeting on May 8th to approve the intermunicipal agreement. And Harwich will be going to the ballot to approve that $9 million funding, which includes that IMA agreement. Both have to pass in order for this agreement to go forward, at least in its current form. So we'll be following that closely.
Tim, I thought there was an effort underway for a tri-town agreement between Harwich, Dennis, and Yarmouth regarding wastewater.
There is. Harwich, Dennis, and Yarmouth held a meeting a few weeks ago to discuss this possibility. What this would involve would be potentially sometime in the future building a plant that the three towns could share that would take care of the sewage from the west side of Harwich.
Oh, okay.
So you know, Harwich is a big town. It's got quite a lot of area and quite a lot of sewering that needs to be done to take care of the nitrogen loading problem. What they're hoping to do is avoid Harwich having to build their own specific plant. If they can take advantage of the excess treatment capacity in Chatham on the east side, and on the west side, work with those towns to do some kind of regional solution.
Makes sense. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
Let's go right to Jim DeRuta, who's joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times newsroom. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Sean.
We've spoken in the past many times, I believe, about Carlos Rafael, and that is the fishing magnate there in New Bedford. Mr. Rafael was in federal court yesterday. Maybe give us the background on this, and then tell us what the newest the news is.
Well, he pleaded guilty yesterday to almost three dozen charges having to do with him. Falsely reporting what he was catching, trying to sell it under different names, and then smuggling hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash out of the country into Portugal. He's going to be sentenced, I think, in June, and they're thinking that he'll get 2 or 3 years. And there's a pretty... you know, he pleaded guilty, said he would like to make sure he doesn't have a negative impact, any greater negative impact than he already has, on the people who work for him, the boats that he still owns and that still have licenses and are still catching fish, and on the New Bedford groundfish industry itself. He's so big, and his impact in this fishery... the corruption that he pleaded guilty to yesterday has had a big negative impact, which has discouraged the feds from trying to regulate it honestly and from being able to determine what's the right science and how to adjust the imperfections in the regulatory system.
Now, here's a guy who owned or controlled, I believe, more than 40 different vessels. Do we know what's happening with his business now?
No, we don't, and that's a big question. That's one of the when we looked at the response locally, that was one of the biggest questions. Came from the mayor, who's New Bedford's mayor, who's talked with NOAA about it, who's talked with the regulators about it, and also with Congress about it. He wants to know what's going to happen to all those permits, and has expressed, as a lot of people have, that honest people who've worked for him or honest people who've depended on the way the fish move through the whole system shouldn't be punished for his corruption.
Yeah, this is a big deal among the fishing industry. It goes across all sorts of lines, including how the fishing industry is regulated and how it's determined who gets to catch what and how much of what. So a lot of questions to be answered.
Indeed, and it's also had a big impact on reputations. It's affected the reputation of honest fishermen. The feds, NOAA just did, the Commerce Department did a big study in January looking at years and years of reporting data from before the catch system and sector quota system went into place and after. And they found that they're really most fishermen are reporting the way they're supposed to and everything matches, and that they found precious few occasions where numbers are wildly off. The hope is that that as they go through and look over Carlos's second set of books, in which he recorded what he actually caught and actually sold, will help to clear up some of the numbers that have also hurt the reputation of the government and its effort to regulate. There have been steady improvements in the regulation of fishing on reporting, with a couple notable gaps, and the expectation is it'll be traced in large part to this corruption that Mr. Raphael confessed to yesterday.
Jim Drew of the New Bedford Standard Times, we have to leave it at that, but I'm sure we'll be talking about this again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sean.
Let's go directly to Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner newsroom. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Sean.
Let's stick with fishing. This time, let's talk about shellfish. Some change in Wellfleet about the size of shellfish.
Yes, that's right. This is a story about Wellfleet's most illustrious product, the Wellfleet oyster, which up until just a couple of weeks ago, if you were to go and buy a Wellfleet oyster at a fish store or a restaurant, the only legal ones that you would be able to find would measure at least 3 inches in diameter from the hinge of the oyster to the edge of the fan. But the Wellfleet, well, the backstory here is that this past October, the State Division of Marine Fisheries decided to allow the sale of so-called petite oysters and surf clams, meaning that their diameter is just 2.5 to 3 inches. The DMF legalized their sale in the state, but the Wellfleet selectmen had not initially adopted those new rules because of some concerns. Wellfleet is really unique in that it has the largest wild oyster set in the state and also the most acreage of cultivated, you know, farmed oysters. But this month, the selectmen decided to legalize the sale of the petites, and it's a potentially very significant change for local oyster farmers.
I understand underside oysters usually fetch about 12% less than the 3-inch. That's what you told me.
Yes. So the petites, or sometimes they're called cocktail oysters, do sell for a little bit less. But I actually talked earlier this morning to one of the local aquaculturists, John Connors, who told me that the advantage really for the farmers is, if they time things right, it means that they would only have to pit their oysters for one winter rather than two. As you may be aware, aquaculturists, in order to prevent serious damage and loss to their product from leaving it out on the flats over the winter, they generally remove the oysters and put them in bags and pit them underground below the frost line, or refrigerate them for the winter and then put them back out on the flats in the early spring. But that pitting process really involves its own loss, and some farmers lose up to 50% of their oysters especially in the second winter, because it normally takes 3 years for an oyster, about 3 years, to reach the 3-inch size. So John Connors told me that if they really only have to keep them for one winter and then they can sell them by the end of the second season, even though the price is a little bit less, the losses of shellfish more than, you know, avoiding the loss more than makes up for that.
Understood. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, thanks for letting us know what's happening in Wellfleet with the aquaculturists.
Great. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, of course, Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. We'll speak with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times as well. And welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Chris Lindahl of the Cape Cod Times. Chris, let's talk about this road work, this project that's planned for the intersection of Yarmouth Road and Route 28. That's that intersection right near the airport there, coming, you know, close to the border of Yarmouth and where you come into Hyannis, right? Now, they want to do a major reworking of that intersection.
Yeah, one of the major gateways into Hyannis. You've got the bus station there. It's a major route that ambulances take to Cape Cod Hospital. You got to cross over some railroad tracks. So what they're planning on doing is adding some dual left turn lanes from 28 onto Yarmouth Road, widening Yarmouth Road, and then creating a shared use path that would partially connect the Cape Cod Rail Trail to downtown Hyannis, as well as adding some new sidewalks and rail crossing gates. But this possibly could be delayed from the state due to some staffing concerns and also some complications with land acquisition from a business that they need to buy land from. So the $9.5 million project, it is set to begin in November, but that could be pushed back.
Yeah, and I understand that officials are concerned if it is pushed back, they'll lose that money in that fiscal year.
Right, so the Cape gets about a $10 million pot of money for all of its road projects from federal and state funds, and there's some concern among town councilors and county officials that if this is pushed back, they might just lose out on the majority of that this year's funds.
Okay. We should note the passing of Christy Myhos, who ran for governor twice, I believe, and was well known in this area. He ran the Christie's shops, little convenience stores that he eventually sold off. He has died of cancer.
Right. So Myhos ran as an independent in 2006 and 2010, and he kind of, in addition to his convenience store empire, which consisted of 150 stores on the Cape at its height, he kind of gained fame in the early 2000s when he was vice chairman of the Mass Turnpike Authority. And at that time, he had predicted that the Big Dig would go billions of dollars over budget due to corruption and mismanagement. And of course, that turned out to be true.
Right. Yeah, and of course, there was a lot of his personal life that ended up becoming news stories in his final years. I don't think we need to go into all that right now, but people can certainly go to the Cape Cod Times website if they want to learn more about Christy Myhos and his political career and pretty much his family life as well. Let's go to the phone, where we're being joined by Barry Stringfellow of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Barry.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. A lot of communities are talking about immigrants and how local law enforcement should respond to immigrants when they get on their radar. What's happening on the vineyard?
Well, after Donald Trump was elected president, a group of vineyarders mobilized and formed We Stand Together, and in large part to show support for the large Brazilian community here. There's so much uncertainty around immigration, so much fear. It was stoked earlier this month when ICE came and apprehended two Brazilian nationals, and of course this week, Jeff Sessions threatening communities. And amid all this uncertainty, We Stand Together has initiated a petition article that's on all six town meeting warrants to request selectmen to authorize law enforcement and all town officials to refrain from using town funds to enforce federal immigration laws. Now, We Stand Together stresses they're not looking to establish sanctuary city status. Although it's well-intentioned, law enforcement officials that we spoke with Every one of them felt like the Warren article was redundant. And in a way, it could have a negative effect because it implies that they check status, which they all stress that they do not check status when they arrest somebody or when somebody reports a crime. So it could have the opposite effect. And also, one police chief was concerned that it could hamper federal funding to the detriment of the public good. And even though they're stressing it's not Sanctuary City, that is not clearly defined as a lot of issues in the immigration policies are now. So the intent is regarded, but the other aspect of this is 287G, and that is where local enforcement signs on under the aegis of ICE to enforce federal law, and we stand together as concerned that that could become part of the protocol on the island, and the chief said they have absolutely no interest in 287G, and Edgartown Police Chief Dave Rossi said he just doesn't really see an upside to the article and that it has a certain distrust with law enforcement that they don't feel they've earned, and like I said, they all stress that they want people to report crimes and not to worry about their status being checked, and that 287G cannot be forced upon them. And Oakbluffs Police Chief Eric Blake stressed that as well. So it's a well-intentioned article, but law enforcement questioned its utility at this point.
Well, it'll be quite the debate at the town meetings. Barry,
sure will.
Yeah, and you'll be there, Barry. Barry Stringfellow of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, Chris. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times, and Chris, let's talk about this really interesting story that made national news regarding an 11-year-old girl who was served with no trespass orders by police. I mean, basically threatened with arrest. This 11-year-old girl, and the reason was kind of surprising.
That's right. Autumn Blanchard, she's a Monomoy Regional Middle School sixth grader, 11 years old. She was served with three no trespass orders by the Harwich police this month. And it all stems from her habit of cutting through a neighbor's yard to get to the bus stop. The neighbors, it's actually two neighbors and they're related, Jacqueline Ledger and Ledger's mother, Patricia Taylor, and they own some homes that are kind of diagonal from each other and they share a driveway. They were concerned about Autumn cutting through the yard because one of them had actually been sued.
In the past, like a liability thing.
Right. They were concerned about the liability of someone cutting through their yard, their private property. But Autumn says, you know, she just wanted to get back to her house as quickly as possible and get warm. It's pretty cold out there.
And she had a friend that she would sometimes visit too. And I mean, what kid hasn't cut through yards? I think that was like it was a rite of passage. That's
right.
what we did. Maybe things are different now. So, but her mother was upset because I guess no one went and talked to the girl's mother before the police show up and give trespass orders?
Right. That was the first that Autumn's mother had heard of it was when she was served, when Autumn was served the no trespass orders. And the mother, Crystal Blanchard, she just says she wishes that there had been some discussion rather than this kind of legalistic approach to resolving what could be a really simple dispute.
And it seems like the superintendent of schools had that same thought as well, that maybe they should have gone and spoken to the parents before, you know, it got to this point. In terms of school officials should have called in the mother, talked to her.
Yeah, Superintendent Scott Carpenter says ideally Autumn's mother should have been contacted. And in fact, he kind of echoed what you were saying. He too cut through some neighbors' yards when he was going to school as a child.
It certainly makes you think there's something more to this than we don't like that little girl cutting through the yard. Hard to say, but then this girl is like, well, maybe it's the color of my hair.
Yeah.
So she's kind of in a quandary as well.
Right. Both Autumn and her mother kind of have alternative appearance. Autumn has some rainbow-toned hair.
Sure.
And the mother has piercing, so they're maybe not your typical Harwich resident, and
they wonder if their appearance has contributed to this.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. it's an interesting story. I encourage people to go and read it. Let's move on. You wrote a story this week about the Cape Cod Commission getting a new member, a second member from the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe.
Yeah, that's right. So Michael Maxim was appointed by the governor to the Cape Cod Commission. Now, the governor has one appointment that he makes for the duration of his term. The remainder of the members are, the majority of them are representatives from each Cape town.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a designated Native American member. So that member who serves a one-year term, that's David Whedon. He's the deputy historic preservation officer of the tribe.
Okay. Okay. So, and they make land use decisions?
Yeah. So they call them developments of regional impact. So certain projects of a certain scale, they need to be approved by the Cape Cod Commission, kind of in addition to the traditional town level approval and any state level approval that might need to occur. Recently occurred the canal generating plant in Sandwich. They're expanding. So that had to go through the Cape Cod Commission because it is something that could impact more than just Sandwich.
And finally, this week, let's finish with a very positive, happy ending story, which it was absolutely adorable. You know, we like birds here on WCAI. Two little baby owls, like I think they call them owlets, were found not in their nest, but below on the ground.
That's right. These two fluff balls were found on the floor by a South Dennis resident, on the ground, rather. So they gave the Cape Wildlife Center a call, and Executive Director Zach Mertz came and gave a heroic rescue to these little baby owls. And he climbed up 45 feet alongside a tree to help reunite these little birds with their mother.
So he climbs the tree on a ladder, and then they rig up some sort of, like, nest that they hauled up by a rope or something?
Yeah, that's right. So they built a new nest for the owl family. And Mertz says that it's kind of an important thing to note. I think a lot of people think there's this old wives' tale, you can't touch a bird or the mother will reject it. But that Zach says that's actually not true. And, you know, you should give places like the Cape Wildlife Center a call if you ever have any trouble or want to help out a bird.
And I understand that the mother was back taking care of the birds within just a few minutes.
That's
and
right.
You have pictures on the Cape Cod Times website.
They're pretty adorable. I definitely encourage people to check them out at capecodtimes.com, and they are very fluffy.
Okay. Chris Lindahl of the Cape Cod Times, first appearance here on the News Roundup. Many more to come. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate it. And, of course, we spoke with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Ed Miller called in from the Provincetown Banner newsroom, and Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. And I'm Sean Corcoran. Thank you for listening.